Okay, so before I begin, thank you first for this opportunity to talk about this program that's based in the South Bronx, New York. And also let me know if you can't hear me. I have a little bit of a cold right now, which I know is a faux pas in the public health community to be out here. I'd like to acknowledge my community partners who are sitting in the back row. I have Charmaine and Diana and then Carlos here who's up a little bit closer. And without them, this program wouldn't have been possible. So the title of my talk is Promoting Healthy Lifestyles Among Children to Prevent or Reduce Obesity and Overweight in the South Bronx, New York, Using a Pilot Program to Assess the Effectiveness of a School-Based Program. And I'm going to take a little bit different approach in comparison to your other presenters. We're less research-based and more practice-based, although there is an evaluation component that I will talk about. And to begin, I have no relationships to disclose. So I hope to give you an overview of the Obesity Prevention Program, which is what we call this program. And in doing so, I have four specific objectives I'd like to hit, and they include going over how school-based programs can work to address the obesity epidemic, the value of the train-the-trainer program model, the importance of a formative phase or piloting a program when you're developing a program or intervention, and then the value of free software, which is an obvious one. So to begin, the Obesity Prevention Program was developed by the Institute for Family Health, which is a federally qualified community health center located in New York. And within the institute is a community coalition called Bronx Health Reach. And so first, the institute, being a center that provides they're an institute that provides primary health care services to the medically underserved. They originated in the Bronx, New York, and now they have 17 sites throughout Manhattan, the Bronx, and the Mid-Hudson Valley. And the Bronx Health Reach, as I mentioned, is a community coalition, and they're focused on reducing racial and ethnic health disparities. And their work includes promoting healthy lifestyles through teaching nutrition education, promoting physical activity, leading environmental change, and promoting equal access to health care. So as the title of my presentation suggests, this work was conducted in the Bronx, New York, and more specifically the South Bronx. And the Bronx, New York has about 1.3 million people, and about 84% of those in the Bronx self-identify as belonging to a minority group. And this is about triple the proportion of the individuals in the United States who self-identify as belonging to a minority group. And in the Bronx, 62% of individuals over the age of 25 have a high school degree or higher, whereas in the United States, 85% of individuals within this age group have a high school degree or higher. And then in the Bronx, the median household income is a little over $27,000 a year, which is almost half of what the median household income is in the United States, which is about $52,000 a year. And then in the Bronx, on average, 31% of the population lives below the poverty line, while in the U.S., 13% of the population lives below the poverty line. So clearly there are some disparities here. And so as my previous presenters have noted, I'm not going to belabor this point because we're all familiar with this graph. And what it shows us is that the prevalence of obesity among 2 to 19-year-olds over the past few decades has tripled, and this is seriously alarming given the physical health, emotional health, and psychosocial consequences of overweight and obesity in children. And then if we look at New York City specifically, more than 1 in 5 public school children in kindergarten through 8th grade are either considered obese or they're considered overweight. And then if we compare these children to children nationwide, children in New York City are more likely to be obese, 21% in New York compared to in the U.S., 17%, and overweight, 18% in New York and 14% in the U.S. And if we look at obesity across racial and ethnic groups, we see that Hispanic students are most affected. And then in general, we also see that boys are more likely to be obese in comparison to girls, although this relationship doesn't hold up when you look at Black or African American students. So Bronx Health Reach is working hard to fulfill its mission of reducing racial and ethnic health disparities, and one particular program they have developed in order to do this is the Obesity Prevention Program, which I'll talk a little bit more in subsequent slides. But first, the overall goal of the program is to promote healthy lifestyles among elementary school-aged children and their main caregivers in order to prevent obesity. And they have two specific objectives in order to accomplish this. One is focused on children and the other is focused on the main caregivers. And so this is the conceptual framework we followed as we developed the program as well as the evaluation materials. And the arrows, as you see, represent the pathways through which Bronx Health Reach's program is expected to have an impact on its students. And the long-term income is to change children's weight for their height. So we measure BMI and we calculate that based on children's sex and their age. And so the Obesity Prevention Program, which I keep mentioning, was developed with funding from the Johnson & Johnson Community Healthcare Scholar Program. And this was done in partnership with several groups, and they include the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, the Social and Health Research Center, which is located in Texas, and then the Cornell University Cooperative Extension. And so what Bronx Health Reach actually did was they adapted a bilingual evidence-based diabetes prevention program, which was created by the Social and Health Research Center, and they adapted it to focus specifically on obesity, and they targeted a particular grade, and we targeted third graders, and you're probably going to ask why, and it's because that's what the funding source sort of dictated. And so the program has four components. There's a teacher training, which focuses on the curriculum that we're going to ask teachers to implement in the classroom. There's the actual nutrition education for the third grade students. There's a staff wellness component. And then we also have nutrition and cooking workshops for parents and caregivers. And today I'm going to focus specifically on the teacher training and then the nutrition education for the students. And so many of you who work in the school system probably recognize that schools and teachers know that their students face many health challenges, particularly around healthy eating and nutrition. And one of the problems is that we don't always have the resources or the time to address both of these issues. So this is sort of where Bronx Health Reach comes in. They're trying to work with schools to fill this gap. And they do this by holding teacher workshops at schools who are not only open to the obesity prevention program, but they're also open to the idea of having teachers implement this nutrition education curriculum into their classrooms. So the workshops are led by the Bronx Health Reach educator, Diana. She's in the back row. I pointed her out earlier. And in her workshops, she covers four very general topics, and they include healthy diet, role modeling, the link between health and academic achievement, and then the actual classroom-based curriculum. And so the workshops are based on a train-the-trainer program model wherein the health educator trains a group of teachers who in turn train their classrooms and the students in their classrooms as well as other teachers. So in using this model, Bronx Health Reach is trying to build a network of teachers who are prepared to do two things. The first thing is that they can actually incorporate the nutrition education into their classrooms. And the second thing that they can do is they can continue to hold trainings on their own in order to continue to disseminate the curriculum. So they can learn the curriculum and then they can teach it to their fellow teachers. And once they have been assured that those teachers understand the curriculum, they can continue to sort of balloon out and the program can continue to grow. So there are several benefits to choosing this type of program model. The first is that it's very cost effective. The second is that it makes the program sustainable because you're giving the information to the teachers and you're ensuring that they know the information, and so you're building that capacity to continue the program. And then it also empowers the individuals who are actually leading the nutrition education in the classroom. And finally, and this is important, is you're translating research into practice. So you're taking what we know works and you're actually implementing it into a classroom. And so, as I mentioned, the program enables teachers to bring nutrition education into the classroom. The program is based on the social cognitive theory, and I mentioned this earlier as well. We target third grade students specifically, but that doesn't mean the program can't be adapted to target other grade levels. It's a 7-week classroom-based program, so each lesson runs about 45 minutes, so there's one lesson per week, and teachers can sort of implement this in their classroom at any point, so it's not, they can choose to fit it in whenever it seems appropriate. And so the topics that are covered in the classroom lessons include eating fruits and vegetables, choosing healthy beverages and snacks, and then making healthier food choices when eating at fast food restaurants. And then we have three specific program objectives that sort of link back to the program topics. And those are to increase healthy eating knowledge, to increase self-efficacy related to food choices. So we want to increase students' confidence in their ability to actually carry out the desired behavior, and then to actually improve their behavior. And so this is a graphic of our implementation timeline. As you see, it runs about 3 years, or you did see. It started back in the fall of 2010 when we conducted a needs assessment. And based on that needs assessment, a program was developed and then pilot tested. And then based on the pilot test, some modifications were made, and then we entered the full implementation phase, which is what we're in now, and we'll be wrapping up the full implementation phase and doing the outcome evaluation this coming spring. And so a little bit more about the formative phase. It was carried out over an 8-month period, and as I mentioned, we pilot tested the obesity prevention program, and we did this in one school in two classrooms, and our health educator, Diana, actually taught the lessons, and 36 students total participated. And then in order to evaluate the program, we developed an assessment, and it's a paper-based measure of knowledge, self-efficacy, and behavior. And these all link back to the program topics, which I mentioned, which are fruits and vegetables, healthy snacks, healthy beverages, and then eating healthier in fast food restaurants. And so the assessment is culturally relevant. Our population is it's rather diverse. It includes a predominantly Latino, African, and African-American group of students. And then I think our previous presenters decided not to assess third grade students, but we made the effort to assess third grade students, which is very, very challenging. So the reading level was appropriate for third graders. And then the program that we used to store the data was EpiInfo, and it's a data management software program available online for free by the CDC, and it's relatively easy to use once you work out some of the kinks which we've experienced. And then the implementation phase, which followed our pilot, we had to make a few changes based on what we learned in the pilot. And one huge issue we were having, for instance, was teachers were not necessarily modeling the behaviors that we were asking our students to model. So we decided to add a staff wellness component because teachers' healthy eating behaviors needed a little bit of fixing along with the students. So our full implementation phase is set to run over 18 months. We've expanded the program. We're now in 4 schools, and we have 15 teachers teaching the program. So Diane is no longer leading the program. We have our teachers doing it. And we have 327 students enrolled in the program. And we're continuing to collect baseline and 8-week follow-up evaluations. And from our pilot cohort, we're also collecting follow-up data. So that would be 6-month follow-up data. And we're continuing to use EpiInfo. So I'm going to show you a few of the results that we have based on our implementation. So if we look at the demographics, we see that A little over 50% of our participants are female. They range in age from 6 to 10 years. And in addition to speaking English in the home, they also speak Spanish and Twi, which is the language of Ghana. And we asked third grade students to report their race and ethnicity, which is particularly challenging. So we got a mix of responses, but they're generally considered Hispanic or Latino, Black, and Caucasian. And so as I mentioned, we wanted to look at changes in knowledge scores, self-efficacy scores, and behavior, and we've broken them out by snack and beverage, fruits and vegetables. And we saw significant changes in all of the directions we were looking for in most of the scales that we collected. So as you can see, we have improved knowledge related to snacks and beverages, improved knowledge related to fruits and vegetables, and self-efficacy improved, and actual behavior improved. And we also measured students' height and weight in order to calculate their BMI, and we saw some changes in that as well. So to sort of sum up the program results are actually really promising. We increased knowledge significantly. We increased students' confidence in their ability to choose a healthy snack and beverage, and that was significant. And we actually saw some improvement in students' reported behavior. We didn't see improvement in their consumption of fruits and vegetables, so that's something we need to work on. And then a few concluding thoughts. School-based programs are a really effective method for providing nutrition education to students and school staff. One thing we need to keep in mind is that these types of programs are necessary but not sufficient to obtain total behavior change. We have to also factor in the environment, which for young students is hugely important. A train-the-trainer program model is something a lot of organizations should consider. It's cost-effective, and it makes the program, in theory, more sustainable. And then piloting a program is an absolute must. It allows you to identify components of your program that are either not working or are missing, and then you can make those changes before you go ahead and expand your program. And then lastly, free software is something that is hard to pass up, especially if you're a CBO that is sort of short on money. And I have many people I would like to thank. Many of you are in the audience, and that's all I have.
About the train-the-trainer.
Yeah.
I work for LA County Department of Public Health, and most of our model is train-the-trainer. But we've had a lot of issues with fidelity to the evidence-based model that we're trying to train. So we follow up with whatever it is, smoking cessation, obesity. So just curious to whether your health educator maybe has shadowed and watching some of these teachers who are now in charge of teaching these lessons to see kind of how faithful they actually are to the curriculum.
Yeah, I can attempt to answer that, but I may actually refer to Diana. We added a component to observe the teachers as they're actually implementing the program in the classroom because we were having fidelity issues. And so she would pop into classrooms when she knew they would be leading the that week's lesson, and she would evaluate their teaching and whether or not they covered all of the different components that should have been covered in that lesson, and then gave them an overall evaluation. And then I believe she met with them afterwards to talk about like what they did well and then where they sort of veered off track related to what we had hoped they would be implementing. But we as well experienced that. So we're trying to figure out how to use Diana as best we can. But 15 classrooms and one health educator is really tough.
My question to both of you is regarding the nutrition education curriculum. I was just curious if that was aligned to the state standard or not. I know sometimes many times that can be an issue, and I was just curious the curriculum itself.
I actually don't know. Diana,
the
do you know?
The curriculum was actually aligned to the Texas National, what is aligned with the Texas standard, and then also the National Health Education standard.
Okay.
So even though they didn't meet specifically New York State, they just meet national.
I'm afraid I can't answer
the
question.
Okay, thank you. I had a question for both of you also. Given kind of the challenges you've seen in having teachers be the agents of change and education when their own weight status or eating habits or physical activity habits aren't what you want to model for the kids, what are your thoughts now, having gone through these studies and seen what you described to us about how to address that, or whether this is just not a viable mechanism of change? What are you thinking?
So I think it is a viable mechanism for change, and I think the way that we're attempting to address some of the teachers' behaviors, or even the behaviors of the staff in the school, is to add the staff wellness component. So I'm not as familiar with that part of the curriculum, but I think I'm going to now turn it over to Diana, because there is an attempt to address the teacher habits in addition to the student habits, and then let the teachers know that what you do is also being picked up by your students. So you're modeling these behaviors that we're hoping the students don't do. So that's why.
Well, exactly because of that issue you mentioned, we did a two-part training. So we had professional development days, two half days that we used. And the first half day was strictly focused on curriculum instruction and teaching the teachers how to do nutrition education in the classroom. But the second half of that professional development was purely devoted to staff wellness promotion, which a lot of the projects I noticed use the School Health Index. And our schools also use the School Health Index to another project and found it's the lowest rated of the eight categories in the School Health Index. So we tried to, that was our way, our attempt to address that. So we spent about 3 hours just talking about staff health promotion, and we also offered this throughout the program for them.
Yeah. I have a question for the HEROES and do they have any thinner program for the HEROES in the schools to do the intervention?
The schools that we are working with HEROES did not have wellness programs. There is an urban district that actually had it had in the past that it had a PEP grant, and so they had some programming that was somewhat fragmented. But the specific schools it had not necessarily had school level programming. So one of the things that we probably should point out about HEROES that we feel pretty strongly about, and the foundation does too, it's actually school wellness implemented at the building level, not at the district level. And in fact, we actually have had instances where grantees have tried to implement that HEROES model as more of a district-based model, and instead there's been a lot of pushback because we've gone in on the schools and then tried to do those implementation visits that Lisa and Danielle spoke about. We found that it had nowhere near the same level of implementation that when schools take the ownership and the building actually creates the wellness council. So, but we could that'd be a whole different paper.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the HEROES. Is that a trademarked curriculum?
I don't know that it's trademarked, but it's the name that they have created for that sort of condensed coordinated school health program.
And they is
the Wellborn Baptist Foundation.
Okay,
in the southern, in Evansville, Indiana. And so actually there's a nutrition program that's actually called HEROES that I came across just a little while ago. But they have named it that, they haven't trademarked it. But that's what they call their schools. They call their schools HEROES schools.
And I'm a school nurse by background. utilize the school nurses and utilize the school nurses as the champion as opposed to the teachers. And I guess I'm kind of curious, the school nurses were involved in the data collection, but not as part of the...
No, that's actually not true. The school, the wellness coordinator could be a variety, could have had a role in a variety of places within the school. And so the school actually determined who the wellness coordinator was, and I'd probably say in about 50% of the cases, we had wellness coordinators who were teachers, specifically PE teachers, and then in probably another maybe 25% school nurses actually served as the wellness coordinators, and then there was kind of another mix. But the school nurse was always involved in the wellness council, and in some cases they were the actual wellness coordinator.
Okay, so you actually did include that school
health
services part of the...
If they didn't include the nurse, they were actually rated lower in terms of education.
Oh, okay. That was my question.
Very
important.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I just wanted to add one to in terms of with the school nurse, because I'm from Camden, New Jersey. We're under the New Jersey School Coordinated Health Program at the Center for Disease Control. And one of the things that the district, they did identify the school nurse to be the wellness coordinator, the wellness overseeing the children. Well, what we found is that a lot of the nurses throughout the district, they found that it was very time consuming. So therefore, then they had to reinvent the wheel and allow half now, half were health and PE teachers, half were school nurses. But school nurses are definitely involved in the planning, implementation, and so forth.
And I would like to add also that for our program, one of our school wellness champions was also a nurse. She's very involved, and I think that she's part of the reason anything happens in that school regarding nutritional wellness. And in our other schools, there are PE teachers and nutrition teachers.
Question for Dr. Rappaport. For example, your presentation, you were discussing how it's difficult to implement the program and sustain it, or the interventions at least. Did you have any suggestions for how to make it more implementable or sustainable?
I'm afraid not. I mean, this was part of a larger project, as I mentioned, to reevaluate this intervention, and the data were the data, and I was not directly involved in the implementation. I think we're simply trying to point out that even with the best of intentions, it's hard to get teachers to go to training, and it's hard to get them to put these nutrition lessons into the classroom because they have other priorities. So I leave it to some of the people who are digging more deeply into that to try to address those questions.
I had a question for the Bronx program. Based on kind of our discussion about the teachers' behaviors, do you have plans, or are the teachers, I guess, interested in hearing about your evaluation results when they're completed, or plans to kind of share those findings with them?
So since we're in year two now, in year one, we did the first program with the first set of 15 teachers, and we collected the data, and then when we did the training this year, I gave them a one-pager with the results of the program. Because also we had some new teachers and there was some turnover, so to also facilitate buy-in, I made sure to highlight the data that shows the positive improvements from the year before.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever considered using speech teach factors to evaluate the teachers' understanding of what they're implementing?
I'm not sure that's been considered, but it's a really great idea.
Oh, I just said, I asked if they have considered using teach back to determine how well the teachers are able to implement.
The teach back method?
Yes.
Yeah, we do that during our observation. So it's done during their training. I teach them about teach back method, and then in my observation, it's part of my evaluation form to see if they're actually involved with that.
I have time for one more question. And just to follow that lady, and so where do you get the curriculum for the heroes?
So the Wellborn Baptist Foundation has program staff that work with the schools to provide technical assistance and support. And basically, they've taken the CDC's model, so the coordinated school health model, and just really focused it in. So it really is the CDC model. And what they have done within that is they have suggested specific strategies to help accomplish programming in some of those areas. So for family and community involvement, that's a strategy, but it's not the only strategy. But because they're trying to sort of help push them and give them concrete ideas, they say, use that one. And that has seemed to well, it certainly helps in the evaluation, but it seems to actually mobilize them quicker.